Have you ever been in a spiritual group or anything?
Yeah, a couple times in like small commune settings, but yeah, they would have this thing every Sunday called a Sangha, and the leader was in kind of the Sufi tradition, and there was a lot of order to the day. Like there was a very formulaic, you know, schedule of we sing and then he reads stuff and then we break off into groups, and there wasn't that room for spontaneity that I probably would have been afraid of, but could have benefited from. I remember at one point I heard enlightenment described as spontaneous action.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just uninhibited action, just, you know, doing and saying whatever comes about, comes to the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a lot in there. I mean, it's close to... Not that I try and define the damn thing, or I hope I wouldn't, but on the other hand, you know, it's a spectrum. It's not either you're enlightened or you're not. There's a spectrum. There may be an end point, the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. I think there is, and there's certainly a beginning point where you're just completely divorced from your senses and all the rest of it. But on the spectrum, I'd say that for me, it's tangibly related to that, the ability to respond spontaneously. And I like the fact that spontaneous and response have the same, that root, the spawn, whatever it is. Yeah. I don't even know what spawn, and maybe they're not connected etymologically, but phonetically they are, the response, spontaneity. What was I going to say now? Maybe that was it. But what I was going to say earlier, why I asked you that question, was that it seems to me that the central fear, the predominant fear in spiritual groups is of the getting your ego spotted, you know, having a protruding ego, right? That's the worst thing, right? And that's... it's a weird thing, because like if we're expressing our ego, it's not spontaneous. The ego is never spontaneous. The ego is always calculating and reacting, you know?
Yeah.
And it's got a script. It basically just falls back on certain pre-programmed responses or reactions, really. But if you're not willing to let your ego be seen, you can't respond either. If you're constantly trying to inhibit your ego, which would be the ego anyway,
yeah.
Trying to inhibit itself so it looks good. Basically, the super ego would be saying to the ego, no, hold on, yeah, uh-huh. That's not appropriate. You're in a spiritual group now and blah, blah, blah. So in order to be spontaneous and develop an ability to respond, responsibility, what I have to, one has to not be afraid of letting the ego show up, being an authentic, you know?
Yeah, I think that's the crucial point. And I think anyone who's looked into various spiritual traditions or religions, that is the goal, to kind of approach the ego, you know, as Michael with the sword conquering the dragon. And it's not something, it's unavoidable while you're alive. And the sooner you just accept it and live with it intuitively and not try to, yeah, it's a tricky subject.
Mm-hmm.
But it's there and it's not going to go away. And anyone who claims it's gone is lying, you know.
Well, what about somebody who's enlightened?
Yeah. Well, I've told you, I do feel like I know someone who is, and I wonder what his response to this would be.
Mm-hmm.
because he is someone who seems to act absolutely spontaneously, and I, but it's him. I mean, maybe it's the ego actualized or whatever the psychological term is.
I don't know what they are, and of course, what the term would be. It would depend what, you know, who you ask, but also what, you know, what we mean when we say the ego. So I guess what I mean, and certainly after, not necessarily after Devashana, because I probably believe this before Devashana, but in tandem with Devashana, that I use the ego in the sense of the false identity or the constructed identity, the trauma-generated defense system, self-care yeah. system, which is self-persecuting as well as self-aggrandizing. And I think that I think one can be 100% free of that.
Yeah.
But I don't think that that would mean, I don't know if that would mean that one didn't have a sense of an identity, and I can't fathom it with Dave, and I don't think it's fathomable. I think it's the whole Christ, the Son of God, God the Son, the incarnation. It's not comprehensible that God could be a man and that man could be God, and yet it's not a hybrid, it's both at the same time. I'd say that is enlightenment, is salvation in the Christian system, is immersion or abiding in Christ, as in becoming one with Christ or becoming incarnate in the way that Christ was incarnate. It's all synonymous, and like, who knows, like if it's experiential or experienceable, it that doesn't make it comprehensible. I just read this quote, or I just incorporated this quote into the ceiling, which I thought was great. In fact, I've actually got it right here, so I'll just read it. We know by means of our intelligence that what the intelligence does not comprehend is more real than what it does comprehend. There's nothing nearer to true humility than the intelligence. It is impossible to be proud of our intelligence at the moment when we are really exercising it. Simone Weil.
It's impossible to be proud of our intelligence when...
in the moment that we're using it.
Oh. Yeah. There's a lot of truth in that. I'm someone who has kind of tried to do away with this need to understand something as vague as what enlightenment is.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, to me, it is by nature incomprehensible, just as God in all religious texts is ineffable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the inherent paradox in speaking about it.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I feel like there's clues between the words and, you know, in those liminal spaces in the silence that, you know, it allows for the thing to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If it doesn't prevent it, there's another thing that I got from Simone Weil, which is that belief in God is perhaps as or even more likely to prevent an experience of the divine than it is to facilitate it. So by the same time, like, talking about enlightenment is probably as likely to keep us out of it as it is to allow for an experience of it.
Yeah.
But then talking about anything is likely to keep us out of an experience of being.
Yeah.
Because it reinforces that part that's constantly comprehending and or relating to what we can comprehend.
Yeah.
But we can't not think and not talk.
Right.
So then I see there's two options. One is just talk about plumbing and just keep it really superficial, not necessarily plumbing, but maybe movies. You and I, we could talk about movies for hours probably, you know, and avoid anything. We probably wouldn't. We'd still get into deep stuff, of course. But you know what I mean? One can just be more consciously shallow and just let the stuff happen under the surface.
Yeah.
Or one can, you know, just take the bull by the horns as we're doing and just see if you can actually hold on for a few seconds and have that experience. And it's not either or, is it? But
yeah,
it's always about finding a way to connect to the other person.
Right, of course. Yeah. For me, it's a rare thing to have these kind of conversations. So I enjoy it. I imagine for you, though, it's kind of an everyday thing.
Not literally, but it's probably a weekly thing. I mean, certainly it can be. And there's more of a danger for me then in that regard, like of it becoming a shtick or something.
Yeah, well, I think it's an endless topic, though. I mean, there's, you know, it's something, whether you find it out or not, you could speak about it forever. So for example, the other day I was running with my roommate. I hate running, and but I felt like I need to start doing something for my body, and he runs long distances, and after, I don't know, 45 minutes, right at the end of the run, we're approaching the driveway, he asked me if I believed in God, and it was the most absurd moment to ask that kind of question, as I'm like heaving. And I just laughed, and it was strange because we never really had that kind of discussion. It was a very uncanny moment to try to wrestle with that. And I just laughed. It was, I don't even think I answered because it just was, the timing of it was so strange.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there ever is a right time for it, I guess is what I mean to say. And there's no way I can ever answer the question.
Directly, you mean?
Right, yeah, yeah.
With a yes or no, right?
To say I do then means I could explain what it is to me, which I really can't.
That's the conundrum. Maybe the conundrum, but or just one, you know, one other way to describe it. And there's I don't actually know the song, but my wife quotes it sometimes, Stevie Wonder song, which says, "When you believe things you don't understand, you suffer." There's a corresponding quote that's in Prisoner Infinity, which is people can only really believe things when they don't understand them. Which I like the sort of paradoxical nature of that quote. And although I can't claim to really understand it, I think it's true.
Yeah.
That people generally really most fervently believe stuff they don't understand. And hence they suffer.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of describes our times really well, I think. You know, with these identity politics or whatever, I think they're very surface level beliefs that are just catering to a kind of politeness or I don't even know what to call it, but I don't think they understand the complexity of what's really going on. And so they claim to believe in it so strongly.
Yeah.
Maybe as a defense, I mean, against even trying to understand it.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I would say I'm just thinking of specifics because my attention's gone back to transgender, and that's one of the things I've gone back to, or trying to take it back to the root, which is gender. You know, the notion of gender itself, it comes from language. You know, masculine and feminine nouns.
Yeah.
And it was... apparently it was used in animal breeding after, so it did, it made the jump, I don't want to say jump the shark there, but jump the cow or whatever, from linguistics to biology through animal breeding, which I'm sure is significant in and of itself, but it only made the leap from animal breeding and linguistics to human psychology. That's where it is now. Who knows, right? Via John Money and the Hopkins, I think it was, and the you know, the psychiatric medical establishment attempting to promote or establish sex reassignment surgery. And because it was understood, there's that word, at the very start, that you can't reassign a sex because it's in every cell of the body. Nobody can change their sex through any means, that may be sorcery. I don't know, refer to Carlos Castaneda there, but yeah, it's in terms of technology, it can't be done. So then I guess Money or whoever the people behind him, whatever it was, decided that they had to first re-engineer the language, you know. And so, okay, they introduced gender as this concept that was an alternate to sex and that could be reassigned. Mm-hmm. So then it went from transsexual to transgender. And now, so how interesting enough, and Hopkins, Money was very controversial because there's this famous case where he did reassignment surgery on a boy who was his penis was destroyed through a botched circumcision as a baby, and Money made the call. I'm sure it was, you know, my suspicious mind was that the whole thing was probably deliberately orchestrated, but certainly Money's decision would have been calculating. An opportunist said, oh, well, we'll reassign him as a girl. He'll never know, right? And so the parents raised the child as a girl, and at about 9 or so, the child started to act up in ways that showed that he was aware that he wasn't a girl, and so eventually they told him, and anyway, he went back to being a boy without a penis, obviously, and eventually he suicided. So the whole thing was a nightmare for all concerned, and what's his name, Money, got somewhat discredited by this, but also the Hopkins Institute that was establishing sex reassignment surgeries, they recognized fairly early on, I think in the 70s, that it wasn't effective. You know, that people who underwent sex reassignment or gender reassignment, it's still called sex reassignment, but anyway, surgery, they weren't happier than before. They weren't less prone to suicide. It didn't resolve the underlying, you know, etiological issues. And yet, despite all of that, we're now at a point where people unquestioningly accept the idea of gender identity. We're having no understanding about it whatsoever. It's really bizarre. I'm just trying to write about it for the ceiling because I wrote a piece and I realized it was too strident. I was sort of trying to, you know, modulate it, make it more humorous, and that it's like people believing in fairy tales. It's quite similar, that all these adults now, because they've been propagandized and indoctrinated with this imperative towards tolerance and compassion, basically, I think is the underlying, that's the sort of shoehorn or the lubricant that gets people to accept these, you know, ideas. But because of that, they've unquestionably taken on a belief about something that they've got zero understanding about, which is the idea of a gender existing independently of biology that has to be, that trumps biology, that biology has to be corrected according to the mythical beast of gender.
Right. Yeah. I heard a kind of haunting story which pointed to one of your articles where you looked at Jordan Peterson as a kind of solar father figure. And so my friend has a roommate whose father died while undergoing surgery to change his gender.
Wow.
Of course, that was traumatic for him. And not long after, he became fixated on Jordan Peterson.
Wow.
And I just thought that was a really interesting proving of your point. Because when you mentioned him being this solar father figure, it really resonated. I actually got to see him live.
Yeah.
Yeah. My mom listens to him and really likes him. Heard about him through her and also you, I think, before. But that was an interesting experience to see him live. Not to just detract into Jordan Peterson, but...
Where was that?
In Detroit.
Hmm. What was he doing?
Well, the first thing he did was maybe the most telling, I felt, is, I mean, it was a sold-out show, and there were no protesters, by the way, but we got in, and someone introduced him, and then immediately he had a standing ovation. And he got on stage, and I think the first thing he said was, well, you're improving.
Hmm.
And I felt like, you know, the only way I could interpret that was like the fact that people were giving him a standing ovation meant that they were improving. It was this very, there was a lot to unpack in that small comment, you know, like a leader and his followers and you know.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, it was really interesting. I mean, besides that, the talk was generally, I found it pretty compelling. Because he was in Detroit, I think he was focusing on really darker elements of our culture and spoke a lot about school shootings and why someone could do this, what evil is, and, you know, all sorts of complex subjects.
Right. Although I didn't hear that one, but when I have heard him talk about those things, I wouldn't say that he goes into the complexity of it, really.
Yeah, that is kind of true.
I mean, certainly not. He doesn't go into the parapolitical complexity, that goes without saying. But even the psychological complexity, well, I guess because you can't separate them, in my view. Like if you've got a school shooter who is, well, even like the Columbine, I mean, even without getting conspiratorial, those two kids, and I haven't researched this, but so we should probably check this, but from what I have heard, they were repeatedly raped by a police officer in that town, or a high-ranking police officer.
Oh, wow.
So even without getting conspiratorial in terms of, you know, maybe they were mind-controlled, et cetera, you don't have to go all the way into that. But just the extent to which school shooters are created by the society, you know, and reacting against things done to them and them, and therefore an institutional phenomenon. I don't think Peterson ever goes there. It seems to me that he just focuses on the evil of nihilism, and when individuals just become totally nihilistic and they feed the evil in their souls and so on.
Yeah, that was more the focus, was that, you know, that was just their way of expressing absolute nihilism. I think he spoke mostly about the Sandy Hook, like how could someone walk into a preschool? Well, that's the highest expression of nihilism, that you could just, you know, shoot a classroom full of preschoolers. Innocence. It's a slaughtering of innocence, which is the pinnacle of nihilism, you know, because the innocent are, well, they're innocent, you know. Kind of brings back to the Christ point.
Exactly. What were you going to say about the Christ point?
Well, just that I mean, that it was a similar situation or argument where he's divine because he was innocent and because he was, well, put on the cross.
Mm-hmm.
I think if he hadn't been put on the cross, it wouldn't be the same story. You know, I think the death and the fact that he was persecuted is absolutely crucial to the story.
Yeah.
It's the scapegoat mechanism is what it's unveiling.
Yeah, and it's also the incomprehensible paradox of existence, which is this, that God, who is all good, creates a world that, in which evil prevails, and in which the innocent is not only not protected, but is most, you know, most persecuted.
Yeah.
And that the Christ, the meaning of Christ was that that which is innocent voluntarily submits to the affliction of the world and the suffering of the world and is thereby resurrected. Right. So that the world and the adversary is actually the instrument of our salvation. Right? So that paradox.
Yeah.
This is almost a confession of galaxies and almost evolving and almost a polygon.
That way. In some ways it's Gnostic, that belief. I mean, I don't want to go that far, but the fact that the world is not inherently evil, but maybe has become evil and will always will be so. But it's we have to in some ways be grateful for that, because it's through that that we find absolution or whatever it is.
I mean, the incarnation is a bloody affair, like from birth to death, right?
Yeah. I just turned 33 yesterday.
Oh yeah.
And I was thinking about that. Well, Jesus, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't saved mankind by the time I was 33.
Oh, you're a failure. Yeah, but it's already been done, so.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so I was, when I turned 33, it was the same year that my brother got crucified.
Wow.
And I was in a car accident. I thought I almost got killed on my 33rd birthday. So that was my, you know, my pulp version of a crucifixion. Very profane. Just on too many drugs, drove off the road, and went into a riverbed and smashed my face and almost died. I mean, no, I didn't almost die, as in I was near death, but like if it had been going, you know, 10 miles an hour faster or something, I could have been, because it was pretty serious.
Wow.
Go ahead.
Hold much importance to that age?
Yeah. I was just going to say, I was so heavily identified with Christ at that time. And it was the beginning of my full Lucifer identification, because it was never either or for me, of course. It was like, I don't know what it was like, really. Sort of start with the shadow, or that Lucifer was the lower or the more physical, the more material aspect of Christ, feminine, masculine, like Lucifer's feminine, Christ is masculine, various different ways that I, you know, attempted to comprehend and believed I had comprehended the incomprehensible.
Yeah.
Of course, I suffered terribly. But perhaps necessarily, I mean, this is the other thing that we said, you know, bringing it back to this, you know, how we're in this world where people are understanding less and less because it's getting harder and harder to understand. Of course, that would be because we believe things we didn't understand. It would, you know, it would be an exponential kind of thing. But that's generating more and more suffering. But the suffering itself in the Christian paradigm, or even the Girardian, I mean, the Christian, it's more than just a paradigm. I think it's the principle that Christianity points towards, is that suffering has a function. Suffering can be, I don't know what the word is, because I wouldn't say it's used, like you wouldn't want to use your suffering, but it can be experienced in such a way that it liberates us.
Yeah, I've always felt that way. I think as an artist with my music, if I'm not struggling with something, I produce very uninteresting music, and I don't feel the need to do it. Mm. I think, not to say that I prefer it, but it is, I mean, I remember you had that debate about the lead singer of Joy Division with that one guy.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it did get heated. But it was really interesting for me, because I've been someone who is I don't want to say benefited, but the process of making the music has kind of exercised my demons, so to speak. Maybe for, what was his name, Ian?
Ian Curtis.
Right, Ian Curtis. Maybe for him it didn't exercise his demons. And that's why it was tragic, but for me, I feel like it does. So in that sense, you know, this, I don't like hold the suffering up. I don't value it. But I use it. I don't even want to say I use it. It makes me an honest person, I guess, to acknowledge it and work with it, mm-hmm. rather than to not, because, you know.
So I'm remembering my conversation with David Constanza as well, The Art of Flying, because I think there's a lot of relevance in that conversation to what we're touching on now. But do you think that when you say that your art, whatever, your music exercises demons, do you think that's accurate, or do you think, could it be that, I'm going to have to be poetic, it'll take too long to say it, that the process of purging yourself of demons creates music, that there's a sound, and it's happening, right?
Uh-huh. Wow, yeah. Yeah, maybe they are inseparable. I never thought of it that way.
Because, you know, like Christians who speak in tongues and sure. that kind of thing. Just
yeah. Yeah, wow. That's a really interesting thought. Because often, I mean, I just finished an album that took me 3.5 years. And if you were to ask me how I did it or why I did it, I could hardly say a word about it. But the whole thing was an intuitive process. And yeah, there did feel moments where I wasn't in control. I relinquished control and it felt like whatever was coming out was just what needed to come out. So I think there is some truth to what you were saying.
I was singing for a while, just as a meditation or whatever. I didn't keep it up, but what I was trying to get to was back to this authentic, spontaneous response. I was trying to, you could say, channel the ancestors, you know, if I wanted to really boil it down to a concept, you know, but that might be unwise, you know, because I don't really know what happens, but that was one way that I was able to try and comprehend it. But to use singing as a way to allow something in me to express that otherwise can't express, couldn't express, and to combine the actual sound, you know, the musical aspect of singing with vocalization or verbalization. So I would start by just making the noises, and I found that I could quite easily tap into something in me that did feel primal and spontaneous and did feel ancestral, putting it in quotes because I don't know where it comes from, but then when I attempted to add words to it, of course that was a really big step and that became really hard, but it wasn't impossible. It was then possible to actually have phrases, coherent phrases, you know, spewing out of me spontaneously that I recognize as coming from some deep part of me and expressing some truth.
I've had that same experience. I don't sing often either, but I've caught myself singing a lyric and was unconscious of it. And I would stop and write it down, and it had that effect of, like, you know, speaking tongues, like, or channeling, or in the most minute way. It was one sentence or half a sentence, but it was it was extremely profound to me. Whatever came out, I remember feeling. Mm. And it's rare. It's not like I can do it right now, but it happens when it needs to happen, I guess.
Or not. I mean, if we don't, I mean, it would happen only to the extent that we create a space for it to happen in, or at least enter into a space. We wouldn't necessarily have to create it. But, you know, when I work in the thrift store, it's because I'm always using this example, but it is, I mean, it's because it's a daily experience that, and obviously I don't sing or channel or, you know, nothing spiritual, mystical happens in that space, but it's still a space in which that allows for, but also almost requires authentic responses. Because otherwise it's unbearable.
Right.
And I think that's back to this, that the world, not just even, but especially in its afflicting aspect, as in its adversarial face of the world, that it's it actually provides an opportunity for spontaneity and authentic responses in a way that being safe and comfortable doesn't.
Right. Right. Yeah.
It's much, much easier to fall into habitual routines when we're just doing what we want and just creating our own environment and maintaining it. Mm-hmm. Whereas when we're actually in, this is what they say about wartime, that how it brings out the best in people.
Right.
And I wonder, you know, what the world we're in today, it's very interesting, obviously, it's an understatement, but in this regard, like, people are more comfortable than ever and they've got more control over their environment, really. I'd say in all kinds of ways, but specifically the internet, social media, you've got, in a certain sense, you've got total control because you can just block people and you can just click somewhere else and, you know, basically yeah. socially interacting, but you've got, yeah, far more control than we would ever have in the physical realm. And yet, so on the one hand, it's like the opposite of war, life during wartime. It's a total comfort zone. Yeah. But on the other hand, conflict is increasing. There's more and more polarization. There's more and more. And basically, I was thinking today, I thought it before, but I don't dread much anymore. I used to dread so much in my life. And I'd say in the last 10 years or so, mostly I've reduced dread to zero, which is fantastic. I mean, just to acknowledge that. But when I do, you know, the most frequent times I would experience dread would be going on Facebook. Just because that's the place I would have interactions that might be kind of, you know, conflict-based. Because right. people post idiotic things and I respond kind of idiotically because it's really hard not to just, you know, match what you see and try and, you know, when somebody says something stupid, there's a tendency to push in the other direction, you know, to try and balance it out with an exaggerated and so on and so forth. It doesn't matter the specifics, but so that's probably the area of most tension and dread in my life is fucking social media.
Yeah.
We left the sun tracing old lang syne. We left the century trying to divine which hill to climb and where to look in the big night sky. The city took with a storm of light. Ignite my heart, ignite my heart, ignite my heart. We left the century with clues in the stars. We left the century, the future was ours. Which hill to climb, where to look in the big night sky. That the city took with storm of light. Ignite my heart, ignite my heart, ignite my heart. We left the century, years like confetti. We left the century, time as memory. So which hill to climb, where to look in the big night sky. City took with a storm of light. Ignite my heart, ignite my heart, ignite my heart. Sky.
add to that all the advertisements and the way it's filtered. I mean, it's the illusion of control in some ways too. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, because you've got very little control on Facebook. You can be banned and blocked for a drop of a hat.
Right.
And you've got no control over the data that you put there. It's, you don't even own it.
Right. But it does give people this feeling of meaning in some ways, or the illusion of meaning, in that what, you know, whatever they say, there's a reaction, and it's so Pavlovian. I mean, it's one of the most interesting and wide ranging social experiments ever.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah. Although that word experiment is always interesting. So when I'm writing about MK Ultra, I always question, wait, why am I calling this an experiment? Because experiment is about testing stuff to find out what happens. And, you know, MK Ultra was whatever. It moved out of the experimental phase a long time ago, kind of thing. And so I guess it's a blurry line, but is Facebook an experiment or is it operational? I mean, clearly it's operational, right?
Yeah.
And it's affecting human behavior. You know, just that one, never mind the whole internet, but just that one corner of the internet, which is the biggest corner, I guess, besides Google, is probably affecting human behavior more radically, more rapidly than anything ever has. Actually, I mean, what would you compare it to? Like Christianity, that took hundreds of years.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there were all these claims around the year 2000 that Christ would return or the world would end. I think the way the internet is now is somewhat indicative of the end, or not just the end of something, but also the beginning of something completely apocalyptic, really, I would say, in the sense of a revelation of what it says about humans as a whole. We've never been so participatory in one thing before.
Right. And along with that, the consent to align ourselves with technology, machine programs, state control, mammon.
Sure. Okay.
I mean, mammon is literally money.
Right.
Facebook is being monetized, as in people are selling their friends and stuff like that, I guess.
Babylon.
Babylon is, I mean, the many languages is one of the key things of Babylon, isn't it? I was thinking of the Tower of Babylon with Babylon, and that was with Facebook, which is the surrogate. It's the another very interesting quote I got from Simone Weil, which sort of encapsulated something I've been trying to express for some time now, which is that those who try to reach infinity by increasing number get further and further away from it. If we think of, and this is in Jordan Peterson that I pointed out, he's always using that phrase in an infinite number.
Right.
Which encapsulates that mindset that infinity is a number, just a really big number.
Right. And, infinity plus one.
Right. And reign of quantity is what René Guénon calls it. And of course, we see this in social media, which is that it's all about numbers. It's irresistible. So insidious, but you've got a YouTube channel, you've got Facebook, you've got Twitter, you're checking the numbers. How many followers, how many friends, how many subscribers, how many likes. That's it, you know. That's how you evaluate your efficacy in this world. And all of this is in the context of a surrogate, as in Tower of Babel, for community, for human shared interaction, for connecting together as souls. So I think if we yeah, it's really so insidious because you can't, and that's the nature of the world, is you can't separate good and evil. They're just inextricably woven together, because you can use Facebook to connect. We're using Zoom now. We're using the technologies to connect.
Yeah.
So it's not as though it's only a counterfeit.
Right. Yeah, I can't be a Luddite. I mean, I use it every day. Do I wish that I wouldn't have to? Yeah. In some ways, but yeah.
Why do you have to?
For the project I'm working on, I use Facebook to connect with people.
Right.
And, you know, do all my own version of stalking of who's friends with who, and because it's useful for this project with Adam, but yeah, I mean, we're all complicit in this, though. I mean, it does seem, like you said, like somewhat of an operation, but it's with our permission.
Yeah, I think that's the operation, is the manufacturing consent thing. And so what are we consenting to is the question.
Right.
Seems to me we're potentially consenting, as said, it doesn't have to be either or. It doesn't have to be complete non-participation versus complete consent, it seems to me, although maybe I'm being naive, but that generally what people are consenting to I'm not sure I want to actually put it into, I don't know if I do want to put it into words. I'd say disembodiment, really, to a disembodied, it's like the opposite of the incarnation, disincarnation. It's like Facebook is providing us for a means to experience or dip our toes in the waters of transhumanism, by which we, this what are they called? The beeman, you heard that phrase now?
The what?
A beeman. A beam is like a new version of a meme, but it refers to individuals. This is straight from a transgender woman, transhumanist mouth. And a beam is basically the amalgamation of any individual's preferences, likes, you know, memories, associations, and so on. Basically, your constructed identity self, your Facebook self, really. Facebook would be a prototype for that. And so the goal, so it's back to this mythical beast of gender, except now the mythical beast is the ego as an autonomous entity that can exist independently of biology, that has rights to exist. So the beeman, the transhumanist drive towards recognizing the beeman, of course, involves recognizing the right of the beeman to exist independently of biology, thereby the right of individuals to choose to be killed, really, as in to have their beeman, as in, you know, their preferences and their memories and their subjective association, whatever the hell we're talking about here, thoughts, in verbal thoughts, I suppose, translated into digital data, put somewhere, and then checked over a period of months by trained experts to see, yeah, this is really the same person, it's got the same memories, sounds like the same person, so now we can kill you because you're part of the, I don't know if they would have to kill, maybe they just die, I don't know, but the point being is this, that's them. It's very contradictory in itself, but I mean, imagine, you know, what a head fuck the transgender thing is in terms of, you know, generating more and more beliefs divorced from understanding, that this would be the step beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, someone dies and their Facebook all of their information on Facebook is still there.
Yeah.
I had that experience recently, and I was going through this person's post, and it was just, it was eerie. It was, you know, it spoke to the idea that we've created a surrogate self that outlives us, that in some ways is more representative of us to people, because that's now the window that people see and judge and rate, you know, the value or worthiness of someone.
Yeah.
And if you don't choose to participate in that web, then in some ways you're invalidated. It feels like, I mean, not that people would outright say that, but if you have participated in it once and you leave it, I know you've probably done this, I've done this, you feel, well, you probably feel great for a while, but you feel a lack.
Mm-hmm.
There's something missing, and it's,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're excluded from the,
right,
from the community. So, back to the counterfeit, because I was going to joke, well, you're not in the Facebook Book of Light. Facebook, you know, you haven't allowed yourself to be assimilated, so you don't get to ascend.
Right.
With the big Oedipal mothership. Like, there may be something really real in this, in the connections that we forge to each other while we're alive, as in make conscious, you know, the more conscious we can become of our interconnectedness or interconnectivity as souls, that may determine our experience after we die, as in we die into those connections, let's say. I'm very reluctant to put this in, you know, into the stark language, but let's say, you know, there's something like this. I know Dante wrote about this, and I haven't read Dante, but I read this passage about the constitution of heaven being that of eternal souls linked together by love, like this living tapestry of souls that are connected through love, and that they are, you know, the love that connects them, and it's one state, a shared state. And, you know, Dante, he was pretty tuned in. And because that's a Christian, it's also a Christian interpretation, understanding the Bride of Christ and the communion of the saints and all that. And but so insofar as, you know, our lives, you know, determine our experience of that, because there's got to be something about how we live our lives, and it means something, right? So how incarnate we become, how much we're able to really uncover and experience consciously the connections between ourselves and others. The flip side of that being that something like Facebook actually presents a counterfeit of that, and you're just connecting to these beamons with your beamon, then maybe we are creating a Borg, you know, like a egregore that is hooked into technology even after death.
Wow. Yeah. The first thought was really nice. I'll try to stick with that one.
Yeah, but you got to have the shadow.
Yeah. I mean, Stranger Things, that show was interesting for that reason, because I felt like it represented that this idea of an alternate world, demonic world, like the Cliffoth of the Kabbalah.
The shells, wilder shells, yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was a really, like, yeah, pretty powerful representation of what it could and possibly does look like.
Yeah, I didn't see it. I only saw a couple of episodes, so.
Yeah. Well, it's making mainstream the MK Ultra story, but all these fans of the show would probably never, you know, never take any of that information seriously. There's this curious phenomenon where these subjects are, you know, mainstream in a show that goes viral, but and the subject matter is MK Ultra, which is a, you know, a very real thing, but I doubt any or many of the people who watch the show would approach the information in it.
They might. I mean, it's a what a blurry area again, and perhaps kind of related as a subject in terms of counterfeit, you know, versus real. Because I guess Stranger Things doesn't actually refer to MKUltra by name.
They do, actually.
They do, okay. So yeah. Then you've got Jesse Eisenberg, whatever his name is, in American Ultra.
Oh, interesting.
Right? So, and it's not the only movie, but it might be one of the only ones that names it. I mean, Conspiracy Theory was Mel Gibson named it. But American Ultra really has that really is taking it to the limit, because it's a romp, really. It's a violent romp. I didn't get through it, so I only watched half an hour, but which is, using MK Ultra as a vehicle, you know, or a context for creating this sort of adolescent fantasy about getting to be a super, you know, badass killer who gets the girl. Well, he already has the girl, actually, but Kristen Stewart. And so it's, you know, it's rehabilitating MK Ultra. More and more, and of course all the Marvel movies, they don't refer to MKUltra, but there's often similar kind of, and the Bourne identity, these superheroes that are products of, MKUltra type programs, trauma genesis.
Yeah, I mean, you were really ahead of it in that idea. I never approached that kind of material that way. Whether fiction or nonfiction, where, you know, there's this idea the abuse is horrible and traumatic, but what comes out of it is worth it. You know, I mean, you have these superpowers, or you have these abduction experiences, or it nullifies the abuse in some ways.
It justifies it. Yeah.
Justifies it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
I mean, it brings up what we were saying about suffering being the vehicle through which you can attain absolution
the world, the adversarial world being an instrument of our salvation.
Yeah,
absolutely. It's levels, really, and what levels, because there's the thing in the scriptures, necessary that offenses come into this world, or scandals, depending on your translation, but woe unto those through whom it comes. Like God is I don't want to end any sentence that begins with God is. That's a bad idea, but well, let's say, you know, God, so far as that word means something, anything, you know, goodness comes from God. Everything that comes from God is good. And so that means that the evil that comes from God is also good. We're just perceiving it as evil, right? But then you've got human beings who have this free will thing, and we're on a much lower level. And this is another thing I get getting from Simone Weil. Maybe it's kind of Nietzschean. I don't think so. But there's the idea that the good and evil that we experience is a polarity. And so you've got evil that's recognizable, identifiable evil, and then you've got good that's in opposition to it, and that they need to be in balance and so on. But the a higher level, there's good that doesn't oppose evil, because good that opposes evil would be on the same level as evil. Therefore, in some ways, it's equivalent to evil.
Right.
Whereas true good has to be on a different level, and there's no corresponding evil on that level. So what I'm becoming more aware of and more able to articulate is so much of the incoherence in our world, and it's a word I want to use more of rather than insanity or evil or what have you, but the incoherence in our world and the deception, the reality distortion has to do with people or we when we confuse levels, and sometimes deliberately. So we recognize, however dimly, or maybe we believe without understanding, a truth, something that's true on a higher level, and then we try and apply it on a lower level. So like transgender, for example, on a higher level, there's no biology in heaven, you know, souls don't have gender and so on. And so you could say we're male and female in one. I don't know, that might be a stretch. But anyway, there's certainly something there that transcends sex because it transcends biology. So if you pull that down to a lower level, then you can come up with these crazy ideas that, you know, biology doesn't define our sex or our gender. Shouldn't say crazy, no, incoherent. So I think the trauma genesis is an example of that. That this is where I got into it with Kripal, and I think that he was consciously or not was taking a higher principle and trying to apply it at a lower level where it simply doesn't apply. Like if you...
Well, yeah, it's the task of a fallen angel. You know?
Nicely put.
Yeah. Back to the Lucifer thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an offensive task and it generates suffering. And although the suffering can be transformative and will have its purpose because everything, you know, extends from God, for the implementer of the suffering itself or him or herself, it'll generate more suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So then that kind of introduces this maddening conundrum, which I got very close to when I was looking at Crowley, was what if Crowley or, you know, whoever knew this and actually volunteered to be an agent of suffering and abuse, knowing that they would, you know, suffer as a result, but knowing that these things had to come into the world anyway. That would kind of, we could see how somebody could believe that would be the ultimate act of generosity and compassion and self-sacrifice.
Yeah.
To be a conscious agent of evil.
Right.
So that, I mean, I really didn't want to go there when I was writing about Crowley, but I also felt I couldn't not go there.
Mm-hmm.
If only to try and understand his psychology.
Sure. I mean, he took kindly to the claim that he was the wickedest man in the world. So I think there was a conscious acknowledgement on his part that he was fulfilling some form of evil.
You know? Necessary evil, yeah.
Yeah, the idea of necessary evil. Yeah.
Yeah, and so actually, I mean, it was the thing I covered with this writing about Crowley and Vice of Kings was, or another example of it, made it more conscious of me. What I detest and challenge and reject about Crowley isn't necessarily even what he did, although I think they were horrific. It's the what's the correct word for that? The rehabilitation, or the, there's a better word where you dress some, the glamorization, but you know, the representation of Crowley as something else, like taking him at his word that he was a liberator and a prophet and a pioneer and all of this stuff. But yes, if he was, let's take him at his word and see what that entailed. And yes, it apparently entailed committing, deliberately, consciously committing evil, including the unforgivable sin, which we don't know what it is, but So yeah, Crowley's been rehabilitated to the point that he's a cultural hero now, and that depends on people like Lavender. Even Douglas Rushkoff wrote a comic book about Crowley as a good guy, only putting forward Crowley's positive side, even though the positive side includes his self-identification of the beast. But it's a defanged, declawed beast who, no, he would never participate in ritual abuse of children or, you know, animal sacrifice or human sacrifice. He was just kidding about those things.
Yeah, but he wasn't, definitely.
So that backing away from truth and recontextualizing evil in such a way it becomes palatable, and it shouldn't be palatable. Like evil, the one thing about evil is it's not supposed to be palatable. Yeah, so that's the thing I object to. And of course, there's a level at which I can not object to that, and it doesn't help to object to it. But it's possible, I think, to approach something at that level of, okay, so I'm not saying that Crowley was evil. I'm not even saying that those who are saying he was a great guy or evil. I'm just saying, let's look at all the evidence around him, and then you decide. Because if you think that you can ritually murder children wholesale, saying Crowley did this, but I think there is evidence that he did, and still be a cultural hero who liberated humanity, well, go for it, you know?
Yeah. I don't find much value in the, I would call it idolatry, really, what people do with Crowley and a lot of these other figures. I would be far more interested in a demystification or not necessarily humanizing of them, but going into the more mundane aspects of their daily life.
Right.
Because it's like when anyone thinks about Crowley, all they imagine are these, black magic rituals or mountaineering feats, or you name it. But how many years was he a drug addict? How many years was he a spy or other not so laudable attributes?
Yeah. Right, but that, of course, that's not mundane either.
That's true.
So it's true, there's a whole area of Crowley's life that would have been mundane, that was mundane and petty and mean and spiteful. But I didn't go into that. I mean, of course, it would be much harder to track and trace that, perhaps. And I wonder if it would be, it seems as though that would potentially be a more effective demythologizer, because the danger, of course, is that if you present, like happened with John DeRuta, more and more evidence that they weren't they're not these saintly figures, they're actually, these high-level psychopaths. Mm-hmm. Well, we're in a culture now where that's so glamorized that that's not going to demystify.
Yeah, that's true.
To many people, they just think, well, okay, so they've already kind of invested to this point. I guess that's one of the things I'm curious about. How far are people willing to go if they've identified with power and the will to power, as it starts being disclosed to them what the real costs are and the real requirements and qualifications or what have you, real tests and the initiation rites, figuratively speaking or literally, how will they continue? To what extent will they continue? And at what point will they back away?
I think a lot of these people would say the ends justify the means with someone like Crowley. Like, sure, he may have done harm consciously, but it was necessary to change people.
Yeah, it was back to trauma genesis, and I'd say it's an impossible thing to take a firm position on. Maybe everything is, but
yeah.
But this particularly because it, even more than transgender, say the frame of reference for it is a spiritual one, because you say that about everything. But I mean, if you're really talking about like Crowley, you're talking about liberating humanity, and you're talking about identifying with a god, and you're talking about living forever and shit like that. Well, I mean, the obvious thing is it's easy to justify any means whatsoever if your end is transcendental, and obviously I get into that, but just in terms of how do you, I guess, because you can't see the results. If you're talking about results that transcend this life, you can't actually measure that anyway.
Right.
So I think it's to more like, rather than saying that if you do these kind of things, if you're ritually doing rituals and driven to power to the extent that you'll commit these acts, then you're fucked up. It's turning it around and saying, if you're fucked up, you will do these things.
Right.
Which seems like, is that a difference? Well, it's quite a subtle one, but it's the difference between a moral judgment and an empirical understanding, you know, that a healthy psyche that is at least moving towards embodiment, it recoils more and more from inflicting suffering on others.
Yeah.
And is less and less driven for anything.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, there's this idea instilled in us in the Western world specifically, but probably in the East as well, but that you have to have these grand accomplishments in life, and that you have to have a trophy shelf, so to speak, and if you don't, then what have you done? You know, how have you wasted your life, or why have you not, you know, tried to quote unquote succeed? And success is measured in these kind of like grand pursuits that have material ends usually, and usually entail squashing people along the way. But once you get there, it's okay. It's okay that you stepped over 1,000 people to get there, or abused people, or, you know. It's definitely just the engine that's driving this culture. I've been, you know, I'm 33, like I said, and I don't have much to to speak for. My possessions can fit in my little car, and I could drive away tomorrow. And you know, but I'm often struck with that feeling of insecurity when I'm around other people who have these lives that are quote unquote successful. Yet they tell me how much that doesn't give them what they thought it would. I mean, you know, well, duh. I mean, to me, I've always, some questioned and also been afraid of that pursuit. You know, I can't say that it's just that I see the flaws in it. I think there is fear involved in even trying to go down that road.
Mm-hmm. Because,
What?
I mean, fear about what?
I don't know, that I'll be swallowed up in the rat race, I guess, or fear of that the way I would apply myself would be false, or I've been repelled by it my whole life, I guess, and it's that that is truthful to me. It is not feeling the need to go down that route of chasing success or money or, you know.